Yes, the chess player. Her colour was hectic again, but her voice had evened out. You know I play a little chess myself, Chris. I never made a big splash about it, like some people, but I play. And it's a very limited game. In the end, it's just you and the other guy. That's not a good model for what we do, Chris. Not a good model for life in general. Of course, it's very male, one-on-one combat, nice and simple. But it isn't real. You need to upgrade. Play something like Alpha Mesh or Linkage, something multi-sided, something with shifting alliances.
Yeah, that sounds more like your speed.
It's the speed of the world, Chris. Look around you. You see the chess players? Sure you do. They're the stupid third-world fucks sending out their pawns to kill each other over an 80-kilometer strip of desert, or what colour pyjamas God likes to wear. We're the Alpha Mesh players, Chris. The investment houses, the consultants, the corporates. We shift, we change, we realign, and the game keeps flowing our way. We move around these horn-locked, back-and-forth testosterone dickheads. We play them off against each other, and they fucking pay us for the privilege.
Thanks for the insight.
Yeah, well, she got up to go. Here's another one. When Mike Bryant drives you off the road on Friday, Mr. Chessman, and he will because he's harder and faster than you, when that happens, just remember, you didn't lose to him. You lost to me.
You still don't know I'll do it.
Hewitt smiled. Yes, I do. I know you, just like I know Mike. And I know you'll go up against him because it's the only chance you have of saving Lopez and Barranco and Barranco's tawdry little third-hand revolution, because I can tell you here and now, Mike Bryant is going to go with Echevarria.
When she was halfway to the door, he called after her. Louise.
She stopped and looked back at him, head cocked at a quizzical angle.
When this is over, Louise, I'm coming for you.
She nodded agreeably. That's the spirit, Chris. That's what I expected. But you're wrong. When this is over, you'll be dead.
She left him sitting there, staring into the rain and listening to the white noise hiss it made. Chapter 45. It rained on and off through the night and into the next morning. The last of the showers sputtered out as he was eating breakfast, and by the time he finished, the sky was brightening. His release order came through about an hour later. The meal tray detail turned up looking unusually cheerful, and told him he could leave whenever he wanted. They'd brought his phone and wallet, a small black carryall for his clothes, and the one who'd loaned him the books said he was welcome to keep anything he was still reading. Chris said he couldn't possibly. Outside, the city was still damp from the rain, and the air smelled rinsed. The weather had cleared the streets of people, leaving a forlorn Sunday feel on everything. A moisture-beaded, shorn limousine was waiting for him at the curb, engine idling.
"We'll need to hurry, sir," the chauffeur told him. "The press release said 4 this afternoon, but you never know. Even the corporate cops have been known to leak. Always a price for drive data, eh?"
In the event, his cynicism proved unfounded. The drive to the hotel was uneventful, and the chauffeur left him alone. Only once, as his passenger was getting out, did the man's professional lacquer crack. He waited until Chris started up the steps to the hotel, then climbed half out of the driver's side door and leaned across the roof of the limo.
"Good luck, sir," he said.
Chris turned to look at him. "Not a Bryant fan, then?" he asked, not quite steadily.
"No, sir. Didn't want to say anything before, in the car, in case you thought I was brown-nosing, but I'll be watching you tomorrow, sir. Betting on you, too."
"That's very kind of you." The attempt at irony wavered away unnoticed. "Any particular reason you're not backing Bryant? Because he sure as fuck is a better driver than me." The chauffeur shrugged.
"Can't bring myself to like the man. Of course you didn't hear me say that, sir."
"Say what?" The chauffeur grinned.
"Like I said, sir, I'll be watching."
Chris watched him drive away, gripped by a powerful desire to exchange places with the man. Secure service job, preferential housing as likely as not, modest means, a modest life, and a probable future measured in decades, not days. Look at him. Not a care in the fucking world. Suddenly he felt sick. When he got up to his room, the sense of unreality was complete. The only visible change since he'd left for work the day he murdered Philip Hamilton was the absence of Liz Linshaw's sleeping form curled into the bedclothes, and the document pouch on the desk. He ripped off the seals and skimmed through the paperwork. Standard challenge documentation, agreement to waive normal legal protection, itemized rules and references to the 2041 revised corporate road charter, dual envelope details, satellite blow-ups, and recent road surface commentary from the relevant service providers. It was the M11 run, practically from his front door, down through the underpass and up over the vaulted section, the gullet, across the northeastern zones and down. The old favorite. No motorway changes, no ramps, just into the pipe and drive. Brutal, simple stuff. In his jacket pocket, the mobile queeped. After 10 days without the phone, it took him a moment to realize what it was. He took it out, identified a video call from Liz, and accepted. "Chris," she stared out of the tiny screen at him, a little haggard around the eyes, he noticed, and couldn't help being slightly flattered.
"Thank Christ for that! You're out!"
"You must be paying a lot for your tips." Her smile was strained.
"Tricks of the trade, Chris. Journalism, I mean. You know what's happening, I take it?"
"Yeah, I got a full briefing yesterday. Has Mike been in touch?"
"Yeah." She winced. "Not a conversation I want to repeat."
Chris tried to think of something vaguely intelligent to say. "I guess he was a lot more serious about you than he liked to show."
"Yeah. And about you too, Chris. That's what really hurt, apparently. As far as I could make out, between the expletives."
"Yeah, well." A long pause.
"Chris, are you really going to—"
"I don't really want to talk about it, Liz."
"No, right."
She hesitated.
"Do you want me to come over?"
Again, the pitching sickness in his stomach, the sheer fucking disbelief at what was going to happen, a rising, swelling bubble of fear.
"Fine. It's okay. I understand."
"Good." The conversation fizzled for a few more seconds, then died. They said goodbyes that were almost formal, and he hung up. He sat on the edge of the bed and looked at the phone for a while. Finally, he called Mike. "Hello, Chris." There was a flatness in Bryant's voice and eyes that told him everything he needed to know. He could have hung up there and then. He gave it a shot. "Mike, you can't be serious about this shit." "What shit is that, Chris? The trail of bodies in Sean conference rooms shit? The political alignment with terrorists shit? Or did you mean the fuck your best friend's woman shit?"
"Hey, you're married to Suki, not Liz."
"Do the words 'you don't fucking make my marital decisions for me' sound familiar?" "Listen, Mike, I'm coming into the office. We're going to talk about—" "No, we're not. I'm taking a half day today. Spending it with Suki, you'll be pleased to hear."
"Then I'll come and see you there."
"You do, and I'll kick your fucking teeth down your throat on the doorstep." Mike's top lip drew back from his teeth. "You just stay where you are and fuck Liz a couple more times while you've still got the chance. If you can get it up right now, that is." Chris snapped. "Ah, fuck you then, asshole. I'll see you on the fucking road." He hurled the phone across the room. It hit the wall and bounced, undamaged, to the floor. He made one more call. Two, to be completely accurate, but when he called the house in Hawkesbury Green, no one answered. He shrugged philosophically and dug Eric Nyquist's number out of the phone's memory. Leaking oil in a head-on collision. It could hardly hurt more than what he'd already swallowed. The Norwegian was curiously gentle with him.
"She's not here, Chris," he said, "and honestly, even if she was, I doubt she'd talk to you."
"That's fine. I understand. Do you know if she's gone home? To the house, I mean. I tried her there, not to talk to, only to warn her I'm coming, I mean." He heard the choppy stumbling of his own speech and stopped. He rubbed at his face, glad Eric didn't have video phone capacity.
I'm going out to collect the Saab this afternoon. I didn't want to surprise her, you know, if she didn't want to see me.
She hasn't gone to the house, said Nyquist.
And Chris knew then she was there, maybe standing next to her father in the cramped, damp-smelling confines of the hall, maybe off in the kitchen, back to it all, trying not to listen.
Okay.
He cleared his throat of an unlooked-for obstruction.
Listen, Eric, tell her. When you see her, I mean, tell her she needs to stay resident in the UK for the next 6 months. Otherwise, the terms of my will are invalidated. You know, the share options and the mortgage insurance on the house. If she's gone back to Norway, Sean'll get the lot. So, makes sense for her to stick around, you know.
There was a lot of silence before Eric answered.
I'll tell her, he said.
Great.
More silence. Neither man seemed ready to hang up.
You're going to drive, then?
Nyquist asked him finally. Chris was relieved to find he could still manage a laugh.
Well, let's just say the other options aren't great.
You can't run?
Shame on you, Eric. Run from the filthy corporate monsters of conflict investment?
He grew abruptly serious, fighting the up-bubbling fear.
There's no way, Eric.
They've got me checked, filed, and monitored. That fucked-up system you're always raging about? That system will be locked up against any move I try to make.
Plastic, selectively invalidated. Corporate police checking ports and airports. Not to put too fine a point on it, I don't roll out the wheels tomorrow. I'm a common criminal on my way to the jag gurney.
Nyquist hesitated. Can you beat him?
Carla says,
I don't know, Eric. Get back to me tomorrow afternoon, I'll have an answer for you. The Norwegian chuckled dutifully. Chris felt his own face take up the echo. He was suddenly, almost tearfully thankful for the older man's unhostile presence on the line. The instinctive male solidarity, the shoring up of his desperate bravado. He suddenly understood how badly he had failed to do the same thing for Eric at the crisis points in his father-in-law's life. How he'd taken the Norwegian's own cornered bravado at face value, failed to see it for what it was, berated him for it, and cut him loose to suffer alone. With the realization, something lodged in his throat.
From what I understand, Nyquist was saying, we'll all know by then. In fact, we'll all be watching you crack open the champagne. The networks have been ads screaming about full coverage since yesterday. Sponsored by Pirelli and BMW, they say.
Chris's grin melted into a grimace.
So? No prizes for guessing who they think's going to win, then?
Almost worth beating him just to piss them off, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
He could feel another bubble of fear coming up. He cleared his throat again.
Listen, Eric, I've got to go. Things to do, you know. Got to get ready for all that publicity tomorrow. Interviews, fame, all that shit. It isn't easy being a driving hero.
No,
Nyquist said very gently.
I know.
He signed the challenge documentation, got the hotel to courier it across to Sean, and sat waiting for receipt confirmation. He studied the route blow-ups and the surface reports with desultory attention, tried vaguely to imagine his way inside something resembling a strategy. He could not focus on anything. He kept skittering off into daydreams. His thoughts slowed down, fragmented to useless shards. He heard Carla's voice.
Even drunk, even like that, he's the best I've seen.
Hewitt's voice. When Mike Bryant drives you off the road on Friday, Mr. Chessman, and he will because he's harder and faster than you, when that happens... He remembered Bryant's driving, Bryant's chess playing, headlong, full-on, joyous in its savagery. Bryant and the carjackers, the boom of the Nemex, the tumbling bodies. Bryant and Griff Dixon, implacable, precise. Bryant and the Marauder, daring the gangwit forward, grinning into the possibility of it. Bryant on crutched friars, walking empty-handed into the duel against 5 men with shotguns. He stared at it all, behind the curtain of his closed eyes, and heard Hewitt again. Mitsui Jones shot through the head at close range while she was injured and trapped in wreckage. The blood of an 80-year-old man on your hands. You're no fucking different from me in the end. He wondered if she was right. Recoiled automatically as soon as he thought it. Found himself lying face up on the bed an hour later, exploring the idea gingerly, like a broken bone or a gaping wound he didn't dare look at directly. Caught himself, finally, hoping it might be true. Because in the absence of the consuming hatred that had driven him after Edward Quayne, he didn't know what else he could summon to keep him alive tomorrow. He had the cab leave him at the end of the drive. It felt strange to walk up the gravel S-curve and see the house emerge gradually through the trees. Just being there felt odd enough. He hadn't seen the place in weeks, and even then, before his life broke in half, he couldn't recall the last time he'd walked from the road. One weekend, one evening, out with Carla in the village, maybe. Back at the start of the summer. He couldn't remember. He reached the turning circle at the top, and the Saab was there, quiet and sequined with rain. He wondered if Carla had looked at it recently. Wondered, in fact, when it had last been moved. He'd need to road test it. Check it for... A memory arrowed in past his defences. Carla under the Saab after a test drive, calling out questions about handling, while he stood with a whiskey in his hand, watching her feet and answering. Warmth of shared knowledge, shared involvement. He stared at the Saab, throat aching. The urge to get in and drive somewhere was overwhelming. He stood for a full 20 seconds like a starving man faced with a large animal that he might just conceivably be able to kill with his bare hands and eat raw. He only moved when the straps on his bags began to cut deep enough into his palms to be painful. Not yet. He dumped the bags at the front door, while he fished the recog tag from his pocket and showed it to the lock. Shouldered the door aside and moved across the threshold. Inside was cold with the lack of recent occupancy, and everything had the skin-thin unfamiliarity of return home after long absence. He stood in the living room, bags dropped once more at his feet, and Carla's departure came and hit him like a hard slap across the mouth. She'd taken very little, but the holes it had left felt like wounds. The green onyx woman form she'd bought in Cape Town was gone from its place by the phone deck. 2 blunt little metal stubs protruded from a suddenly naked patch of wall, where the flattened and engraved Volvo cylinder head from her mechanics graduation had once hung. On the mantelpiece, something else was gone, like a pulled tooth. He couldn't remember what it was. The framed photos of her friends and family on the window ledge had been weeded out from others of Chris and Carla, or Chris alone, and the remaining crop looked stranded on the white wood like yachts run aground. The bookshelves were devastated, the bulk of their occupants gone, the rest fallen flat or leaning forlornly together in corners. He had no stomach for the rest of the house. He unpacked his bag across the sofa, slung the Nemex and his recently acquired Remington into an armchair. The sight of the weapons brought him up short. He'd never brought the Nemex inside before this, he realized. Even when they'd gone to the Brundtland that fucking night, he'd had to get it from the glove compartment of the Saab. It felt as alien now, perched on the soft leather of the armchair, as the absences where Carla had taken things away. It felt, in an odd way, like an absence of its own. He picked up the shotgun because it delayed the time when he'd have to go upstairs to the bedroom. He pumped the action a couple of times, deriving a thin satisfaction from the powder-dry clack-clack that it made. He lost himself in the mechanism for a while, put the thing to his shoulder and tracked around the room like a child playing at war, pausing and firing on the spaces Carla had left, and finally on the image of himself in the hall entrance mirror. He stared for a long time at the man who stood there, lowered the Remington for a moment to get a better look, then pumped the action rapidly, threw the shotgun to his shoulder, and pulled the trigger again. He went out to the car. Later, as evening was falling, he parked again and went back into the house for the second time. with darkness shading in outside and the lights on, the blank absence of things and Carla seemed less brutal. He'd already eaten. He locked the door and went straight up to the bedroom. Carla had taken her scrubbed granite analog clock from the bedside table, and the only other timepiece in the room was on the dressing table, an old Casio digital alarm they'd bought together at some antiques auction years back. Chris lay in the dark for a long time, staring at its steady green numerals, watching the seconds of his life turn over, watching as the last minutes of the day counted down to zero and the new morning of the duel began. He didn't sleep. He couldn't see the point. Chapter 46. They were talking about him as he turned on the TV.
"For a driver of that rank, it's not really what you expect, is it, Liz?"
"I think that depends, Ron."
She was resplendent in a figure-hugging black scoop-necked jersey, light makeup, hair-pinned casually up. Looking at her made him ache.
"It's true Faulkner's form since Quain has been variable, but that doesn't necessarily make it bad. I know from interviewing him myself that he simply doesn't see blanket savagery as an asset."
"Whereas Mike Bryant does."
"Well, again, I think you're simplifying. Mike's form is more consistent, more conservative, you might say, and yes, he certainly isn't afraid to go foot to the floor when it counts. But he's not cast in the same thug mould as, say, someone like Yo at Mariner Sketch, or some of the imported drivers we've got from Eastern Europe. That's savagery as a default setting. That's not Bryant at all."
"You know them both quite well."
She made a modest gesture.
"Mike Bryant was one of the main sources for my book, The New Asphalt Warriors, and I've been working with Chris Faulkner, among other drivers, on a follow-up. I hate to plug so blatantly, but—"
"No, no, please."
Mannered laughter.
"Well, then, it's called Reflections on Asphalt, Behind the Driver Mask, and it should, my workload permitting, be out sometime in the new year."
She grinned professionally into the camera.
"It'll be a great read, I promise."
"I'm sure it will."
Face to camera. Pause and cue.
"So now let's go over to our live coverage crew at the Harlow helideck. Sanjeev, can you hear me?"
"Loud and clear, Ron."
The inset screen sprang up. Maximized windswept backdrop, rotors, and the location anchor sweeping disheveled hair out of his eyes as he spoke.
"So what's the weather like up there?" "Oh, looks as if the rain's holding off, Ron. Maybe even some chance of sun later on, the forecast people tell me." "Good driving conditions, then?" "Yes, it looks like it. Of course, we won't be allowed over the envelope until 20 minutes or so after the duel ends, but I'm told the roads have more or less dried out, and with the summer repairs on this stretch completed well ahead of schedule, this promises to be—"
He told the TV to sleep, finished his coffee, and left the espresso cup standing on the phone deck. Brief existential shiver as he looked at it and realized it would still be there tonight, untouched, whatever happened on the road today, wherever its owner was. He shook off the chill and settled his jacket on his shoulders. In the hall mirror he put on his tie with a languid, frictionless calm that was just the right side of panic. His hands, he noted, were trembling slightly, but he couldn't decide if it was fear or caffeine. He'd dosed himself pretty heavily. He finished the tie, looked at himself in the mirror for what seemed like a long time, checked for keys and wallet, and went out to the car. He pulled the door of the house closed and breathed in, hard. The morning air was still and damp in his lungs. Gravel crunched to his left.
"Chris?"
He spun, clawing at the shoulder holster. The Nemex came out. Truls Vasvik stood at the edge of the house, hands spread at waist height. He smiled, a little forcedly.
"Don't shoot me. I'm here to help."
Chris put up the Nemex.
"You're a little late for that."
"Not at all. This is what I believe you English guys call the nick of time."
"Yeah, right."
Chris shoved the Nemex back into the shoulder holster, spoiling the blunt gesture a little as the gun failed to clip in. He pushed a couple more times, then left it. Clicked the car key with his other hand, and the Saab's lights winked at him as the alarms disabled. He stepped toward it.
"Wait, Chris, wait a minute."
Vasvik moved to block him, hands still held placatory at his sides.
"Think this through. Bryant's going to kill you out there."
"Could be."
"And what? That's it? The great macho sulk? Kill me and be done with it. See if I fucking care. What does that achieve, Chris?"
"I don't expect you to understand."
"Chris, I can get you out of here."
The ombudsman pointed.
"Back that way. Through the woods. I've got a 3-man team back there and a covered van. Sealed unit, medical waste documentation. It'll get us through the tunnel without checks. You get your $1 million, you get the job. All you've got to do is come with me."
Out of nowhere, Chris found he could grin. The discovery made his eyes prickle and put a ball of sudden, savage joy in the pit of his stomach.
"You've not been keeping up on current events, Truss," he said. "I'm globally famous these days. My face is right up there with Tony Carpenter and Inez Zekina. Everybody knows who I am. What kind of ombudsman is that going to make me?"
"Chris, that isn't important. We can—"
"What are you going to do then? Give me a new face?"
"If necessary. But—"
"And the $1 million? Well," Chris tutted regretfully, "that just isn't such a lot of money any more, Truss. I'm up for junior partner. That's equity. Capital wealth. Several million, plus benefits."
"Or cremation later today." Chris nodded. "There's a risk of that. But you know what, Truss? The thing you guys will never understand. That risk is what it's all about. Risk is what makes winning worth it."
"You aren't going to win, Chris."
"Thanks for the vote of confidence. I'll see if I can live up to it. Now, if you'll excuse me—" He stepped forward. Vasvik stayed where he was. Their faces were a hand breadth apart, eyes locked.
"Don't think I don't know what you're doing, Chris."
The ombudsman's voice was low and taut.
"You think this is going to pay off what you've done to Carla and everybody else? Don't be a fucking child. Being dead doesn't solve anything. You've got to live if you're going to make a difference."
Chris grinned again.
"Well, that's about as good a defense of cowardice as I've ever heard. I guess you need that working where you do."
He saw the flare in Vasvik's eyes.
"Yeah, that's it, Truss. Back the fuck off. Go file a report or something. You came and asked, and I turned you down." "You're a fool, Chris. You've pissed away your marriage, pissed all over your wife."
The Nemex came out again, smoother this time, and he jammed it under Vasvik's chin.
"Hey, that's my fucking business."
The ombudsman smiled with one corner of his mouth. He went on talking as if the Nemex weren't there.
"And now you're going to piss your life away, too, just to make Carla Nyquist cry over your corpse."
Through gritted teeth,
"I told you—" "And she will."
Vasvik saw the change in his face, and reached up for the Nemex. He curled his fingers around the barrel and pushed it away. His eyes were icy with disgust.
"Yeah. She'll cry for the next 10 years of her fucking life over you, Chris. But then, she would have done that anyway, whatever happened. Whether you were dead like you're going to be, or just dead inside, like you already are."
Chris gave him a fixed little smile and stowed the Nemex again.
"Get out of my way."
"My pleasure." Vasvik stood aside and watched him climb into the Saab. The engine awoke with a rumble like distant thunder. Chris closed the door and put the car in gear. As he let out the clutch and the Saab began to crawl forward, something in the ombudsman's face made him crank down the window.
"Oh, yeah, Vasvik. Speaking of millions, I forgot. You heard they're going to make a movie about me?"
"Yeah," the Norwegian nodded somberly.
"I heard. Make a great ending if you and Bryant managed to kill each other both."
Gravel crunched under the wheels.
"Fuck you." "No, really. I'd go and see it."
He hit the turn for the ramp, going too fast, ignored the bounce, and accelerated down onto the motorway. Vasvik's offer was gone, like Vasvik himself. Like conscious, long-term thought, bundled up and flung out behind him, flapping on the road in the rear view. Over and out of reach. There was only the road ahead and his hold on the car around him. The Saab snarled throatily to itself as he picked up the center lane and flipped on the comm set.
Driver control.
This is Chris Faulkner, driver clearance 260B354R. His voice was even in his own ears. He felt a quickening of the joy in the pit of his stomach. He felt armored. Inbound on M11 for partnership challenge. I'm looking for the dual envelope. There was a brief pause. He wondered suddenly if any of the same crew who'd worked the Gangwit carjack fiasco were on today.
Got you, Faulkner. You're about 20 kilometers off the northern edge. We will advise when you breach. Leave the channel open.
Traffic?
Executive traffic has been disallowed until 9:30. You have two automated bulk transporters currently inbound within the envelope, moderate loads, and maintenance vehicles at Junction 11. Please note that collateral damage to said vehicles is not permitted within the dual protocol.
Noted.
So, where's Bryant, then?
Another pause. You could hear the outrage.
That information is classified under dual protocol. Please do not request it again.
Noted. The sense of humor failure, I mean.
Please also note that selective jamming is in effect within the envelope. You will be unable to receive outside transmissions other than our own.
Thank you, driver control. I have done this before a couple of times. He settled into his speed. The overgrown margins of the motorway flashed past on either side in a bumpy green blur. The asphalt fed thrumming under his wheels and fled in his wake. The sense of power grew, feeding off the caffeine and adrenaline. Dying suddenly seemed a long way off. A ridiculous rumor he didn't believe, something he wouldn't get around to. Reality was the road. He hit the dual envelope, tore through it at 160. Driver control squawked the fact whole seconds late. Peripheral glimpses of huddled vehicles on the bridge and ramps, police lights, news crew vans, and a rising boil of activity as the Saab slammed past them. He thought he felt the lenses of the cameras swing hungrily to follow. No. You've just had way too much coffee. A slightly hysterical laugh sat behind the thought. He forced it down and watched the hurrying perspective of the road, keyed up for the evening blue flash of Mike's BMW. His speed sank to a more cautious 130. The ghost of a strategy floated up behind his eyes. Retained knowledge of the route from the blow-ups, sense of how Bryant drove. Bryant. He grinned wolfishly, folded away his misgivings, gave in to the pure, hot flow of too fucking late now.
Come on, you motherfucker.
I took Liz off you. Now let's see about that pretty blue car. Let's see about your plastic. Lopez, Barranco, the men and women in the gunship, tortured highlands of the name, but most of all, Bryant. Bryant and his craven, fucking keep-the-rain-off-me need for Hewitt and Notley and all the rest of it. He mapped the faces over. Bryant into Quain. Just another murderous fucking suit. Just another... The Saab hammered down toward Junction 10. The first of the automated transporters blew up in his vision, nailed to the center lane. Chime from the proximity alert as he swung the Saab out and past. Got deep satisfaction as the car swayed and then straightened out under his hands. The high metal wall slid away on his left and he swung back in. The road ahead. Impact. He was still swimming in the warm gut swirl of car control. Flash of twilight blue in one wing mirror, metallic screech of impact from the rear, jolt of the crash, the seat belt webbing grip across his chest. He braked instinctively, remembered the transporter, and slewed the Saab hard right. The automated vehicle's collision alert split the air, blaring banshee outrage above and behind him. He didn't have time to see if it had braked. Mike Bryant's BMW shot past on the left, shedding speed and hauling across to stay with the Saab. Forcing the duel right here, right now, right under the grill of the transporter. He swam the blind spot, Chris knew numbly, shadowed the automated vehicle from the front, until he spotted Chris in the depths of the wing mirror, falling back on the left as Chris overtook right, timing it on instinct, pinning the Saab's blind spot as it emerged ahead of the transporter, getting up close for the ram. Even drunk, even like that, he's the best I've seen.
He's harder and faster than you.
Chris saw the BMW coming side-on and hauled over savagely. The two cars met with a shriek, flayed paint and sparks in the crushed air between. Counterforce tried to push them apart again. Chris kept the clinch, steering against the other car so the grating scream ran on like nails down a blackboard. Bryant rode it, forcing him back and closer to the median. The BMW's greater weight was telling. The plan loomed massively clear. Side impact at this speed would smash the barrier down but not clear it. The wreckage would kick the Saab into the air like a toy. Options. Behind them, somewhere, the automated transporter came on, an unknown quantity Chris didn't have time to look for. Desperation crept out, flicker tongued in his guts. He floored the accelerator, but the BMW's nose already had him blocked. Bryant had locked with careful malice, half a meter ahead of neck and neck, enough to cut off any escape forward. Now, through both side windows, he looked over at Chris and ripped a cocked thumb across his own throat. He was grinning. The crash barrier. Chris hit the brakes with everything he had. The Saab staggered, jerked free of the sparking, sandpapering fury on its left flank. There was time for a flash glimpse of the transporter coming up, and he hauled hard left across Mike's rear, across the center lane, and out of the automated vehicle's path. Another blaring of machine rage, and the transporter thundered past on his right, cutting off vision of the BMW and what it was doing. Chris gritted curses and let them both go. Junction 8. His speed bled down to an unsteady 90. Adrenaline reaction sloshed in his guts. He caught a distant glimpse of the BMW disappearing down the incline toward the underpass. It didn't take much imagination to work out what was coming. He had about a minute, he reckoned. After that, somewhere down in the gloom of the tunnel, Mike Bryant would have executed his 180-degree crash-stop turn, would be barreling back up the road toward him, for the head-to-head chicken. That old number. The Mike Bryant profile. Fearless, headlong, savage. Conservative to the end. Chris built speed, cranked his nerves back up to drive tension. He passed the transporter again, head buzzing with calculation. Two outcomes for this. The head-to-head kills the duel, one way or another. Saab or BMW out of the game, turned too hard, too late, and tumbled into the path of the long-suffering transporter, maybe, or maybe both cars, clipped against each other, tossed effortlessly apart with kinetic energy raging off at all angles, looking to shed itself in impact and flame. Or we both make it, and you're south, up and into the gullet. No way to fight, but slow down and let him ram you off into space like Hewitt did to Page, or try for the turn, 180 screaming degrees on a vaulted highway only two lanes across. He thought of this. He thought it out. Three-stage play, the crash barrier, the head-to-head, the end game in the gullet. And he knows you can't make that turn. The BMW bloomed in the road ahead. Up out of the tunnel ramp, very fast. He had time for a glance at the speedo, saw 100-something, insane, doubled it in his head for Bryant's share of the speed, saw the BMW's armored snout coming at him, rock steady and directly ahead. "He's harder and faster than you." And yelled, and hauled hard right. The BMW flinched fragments of a second later, flashed past. Was gone. Chris floored the accelerator, and the Saab dived for the tunnel. Again he had a minute at best, not the time he needed, he'd have to make some more. The tunnel flew past in the hollow roar of the Saab's echoed passing. Up, out of the gloom, and into sudden, watery sunlight, the gullet flung itself down at him like a massive asphalt loading ramp. He rose to meet it, took the first curve at the very edges of his driving ability. Felt his heart stumble, as the Saab palpably gathered enough sideways momentum to skid. He dared not brake, there wasn't time, he needed the straight at speed. He unhinged the angle of the turn a miserly couple of degrees, slewed back across the double lane, fishtailing, muttering imprecations to the car. The Saab came back to him. He picked up the long rise and fall of the straight and ran for the next curve. Almost to the end of the gut-tickling swoop, almost on the curve, he choked off his speed and threw the Saab into a shrieking, gibbering handbrake turn. For one very long moment he thought he'd fucked up, thought he'd lose a tire, and then the car, and plunge with it through the crash barrier into the zones below. The car slithered, tripped drunkenly across a badly mended pothole, screamed protest and tire smoke he could suddenly smell, and stopped. Not the 180, just a 90-degree sprawl across both lanes, blocking the gullet like a bone in the throat. Back along the straight, the BMW came over the rise. He grabbed the shotgun from the passenger side footwell, threw open the driver's side door and tumbled out of the car, found his feet, found the BMW, and cranked the action of the tactical pump. Curiously, now that the situation was drawn, everything seemed very quiet. The Saab had stalled out in the turn, and the BMW's engine noise seemed almost inaudible past the distant ocean roar of his own pulse in his ears. The wind came and tugged at his hair, but gently. The sprawl of cordoned zone housing below seemed to be holding its breath. He let Bryant come on for another second, then put the first shot into the driver's side half of the windshield. The familiar boom. He'd done a solid hour down in the armory firing ranges, a final tuning of his earlier, unexpected love affair with the long gun. The BMW's windshield cratered and crazed. He saw the splinter lines. No discharge or projectile weaponry from a moving vehicle. The parchment dry conclusion of the legal board of inquiry after the Nakamura playoff. No substantial destruction to be inflicted with a projectile weapon. Provided these directives are adhered to. Bryant's windshield was armored glass. Even with a state-of-the-art vehicle shredder load the armorer had shown him, care of Heckler and Koch, the roadblock ammunition of choice for all your urban enforcement needs, even with that, at this range there'd be no substantial destruction. He pumped the action, fired again. The spider-webbed glass re-splintered almost to opaque. It was pushing the envelope. Pushing it the way Jones and Nakamura had done, pushing it the way Notley liked. The BMW came on. Behind the ruined windshield, Bryant had to be almost blind. Chris pumped in another round, ran sideways to get the angle, went after the leading tire. The shotgun kicked. The tire blew into shreds. No substantial. The BMW slewed violently across the road, brakes shrieking protest, scorching rubber into the road and the wind. Precedent, Chris. That's what counts. In the elite, you don't get punished for breaking the rules. Not if it works. The BMW careened past him, ploughed through the crash barrier and plunged over. It took less than a pair of seconds. Chris had time for one glimpse through the side window. Mike still fighting the wheel for control. Then the big car was gone, and there was only the ragged gap in the barrier to mark its passing. Breath held. A flat, oddly undramatic metallic crump from below. Then nothing. Done. Won. Finished. Emptied out. Nothing. It coursed through him like current, that nothing. Emptiness, building to ecstasy. He threw back his head and screamed at the sky. It wasn't enough. He couldn't get it all out. He screamed until his throat felt ripped and his lungs locked up on empty. Until he gagged, finally, to a halt. It wasn't enough. Echoes rippled out across the cityscape below, chasing each other off toward the cluster of glass and steel towers on the skyline. Overhead, even the clouds seemed to hurry away from the sound. Behind them, the sky was a flawless, vacant blue. Against all the odds, it was going to be a beautiful day. Chapter 47. You bring back their plastic. Stranded atop the marching pillars of the gullet, listening to his own pulse and the echo of his screams, Chris heard Hewitt's words with hallucinatory clarity. It was as if the woman were standing next to him in the wind. You go in and you finish the job. If you can, you bring back their plastic. He peered down on the zone sprawl below. As far as he could tell, the BMW seemed to have fallen through the roof of a decaying commercial unit. He scanned the surroundings in both directions and spotted his access point. 50 meters farther along the gullet, a caged staircase wound down around one of the concrete support pillars and came out at the end of a shabby residential street. It looked as if there might be a foot passage through from the street to the commercial units. With luck, he could be in and out in 10 minutes. He jogged slowly along the road to the top of the staircase. There was an ancient padlock on the rusting iron cagework. He leveled the shotgun, remembered the jagged vehicle shredder load, and thought better of it. He reached for the Nemex and found an empty holster. Fuck. He remembered the way the gun had refused to clip in while he talked to Vasvik. Remembered tumbling out of the Saab with a shotgun. He looked back along the road to where the car was slewed. No sign of anything on the asphalt. But he could have skidded away under the belly of the vehicle, or fallen while he was still inside. Well, that's it. You can't get down. Have to leave it for the clean-up squad. Not like they'll take long to get here. The relief gusted through him. Dual etiquette forbade outside approach for a regulation 20 minutes, except in medical emergencies. But they'd reel in the situation on satellite blow-up, see the way it had played out, and be here pretty soon. All he had to do was sit at the edge of the road and wait. But he knew what Hewitt would say. Knew how the whisper would run among the junior analysts on the floor below. Yeah, sure, Faulkner's some natty driver. But the way I heard it, no stones when it comes to the consequences. Too soft to pick a corpse's pocket. Fuck it. He locked on the Remington's safety, reversed the weapon, and pounded at the rusted lock until it gave. Dull clang of metal on metal. Orange flakes of rust scattered around his feet. The lock snapped and hung severed. He levered the cage door open and picked his way down the steps. At the bottom, it was the same story. Another grilled iron door, another rusted lock, this time on the inside, as if a retreating army had fought a rearguard action out of the zones and up onto the highway. Weeds had grown up to shoulder height on the other side of the grill, effectively hiding the bottom of the staircase from outside view. From the inside, you could barely see the twinned row of black, brick-terraced housing beyond. Chris craned his neck and stared through the nodding heads of the weeds, listening, trying to get some sense of whether there was anybody nearby. Nothing stirred. He started hammering at the lock, slipped a couple of times, scraped his hand on the rusting iron. It was hard to maneuver the shotgun in the confines of the cage, hard to get a working angle. When he finally stepped out through the weeds, he was sweating and sticky inside his suit. The street beyond was empty. He scanned the frontages. The only motion was the flap of plastic sheeting over a broken upper window. A wrecked and rusted Land Rover, one of the late models modified to burn alcohol, was beached on its axles about 20 meters down the street. It was skeletal, stripped of everything that would come off, the frame scorched Molotov cocktail black where rust had not yet crept in. He spotted the passageway a couple of houses beyond on the left and moved cautiously out into the street. Unrepaired potholes gaped in the cracked asphalt, some of them wide enough to take the whole front end of the Saab. He moved a couple of steps at a time, painfully aware of the windows looking down on either side, pausing to listen every 2 meters. Belatedly, he remembered the Remington's safety and thumbed it off. Pumped out the last spent shell. The harsh metal noise it made shattered the quiet. Suit and shotgun, he reasoned nervously. It ought to keep the flies off long enough. He swung wide around the burned-out Land Rover, feeling slightly ridiculous as he covered the angles. He cleared the corner of the passageway, moved down past high brick walls topped with broken glass. Detritus crunched under his feet. The passage came to an end amid shallow mounds of weed-grown rubble and a clutch of leaf-canopied trees. He climbed the first one with difficulty, burying his Argentine leather shoes to the ankle in little avalanches of sliding soil. From the top he saw the corrugated metal side of the commercial unit, and a loading bay door, rusted open on empty square meterage beyond. In the gloom he could make out half of the BMW lying on its back. A qualified relief at his own navigational skills seeped. Motion. He whipped around, finger tightening on the Remington's trigger, and snatched it away again, as if the metal were hot. On the downslope of the next mound, two children around 4 or 5 years old were playing a game with the slaughtered limbs and torsos of plastic dolls. They froze when they saw him, then scrambled to their feet and started shouting.
"Zective shit! Zective shit! Zective shit! Zective shit!"
He shook his head, lowered the shotgun, and wiped a hand across his mouth. This close, the vehicle shredder load would have...
"Zective shit! Zective shit!"
Elfin faces distorted with the force of the chant. A woman's voice came from one of the houses, raised and harsh with anxiety. The children vectored in on it, looked at each other for a moment that was almost comical, and then darted away like spooked animals. They scrambled across the mounds of rubble and through a hole in a wall he hadn't seen. He was left, looking at the plastic carnage of dismembered dolls. Fuck. Fuck this. Fuck Louise Hewitt and her fucking plastic. But he went on, over the rubble mounds, up to the loading bay door, and through. Inside it was cold. Water dripped ceaselessly from the girder-laced roof and puddled along the lines of unevenly laid concrete flooring. The BMW lay under the hole it had made, nose to the floor, with the weight of engine and armour, back end in the air. There was a faint hissing from the front, and steam curled out through a gap where the hood had crushed out of true. Otherwise it looked remarkably undamaged. The armouring had stood up. Chris moved crabwise to the driver's side door, hesitated a moment, and then hooked it open. Bryant tumbled out like a bundle of unwashed clothes. Suit blooded, eyes closed, and mouth open. One arm trailed across the floor at an impossible angle to the rest of the body. Nausea. The rising tide of delayed reaction from the duel. Chris pressed his tongue hard against the roof of his mouth and knelt beside the body. He stowed the shotgun under his arm and flapped back one side of Bryant's jacket. The wallet gleamed gold-cornered from the inside pocket. He took it between thumb and forefinger and tugged it free, flipped it open. The photo of Suki and Ariana smiled up at him, opposite Mike's racked plastic. A hand closed around his leg. Chris almost vomited with the shock. The shotgun clattered across the floor. He stumbled away from the car, broke the grip, and saw. Bryant was still alive, eyes wide and staring up out of his inverted face. His good arm made feeble motions. His mouth opened and closed silently, like a landed fish. It was impossible to tell if he recognized Chris or not. "You go in, and you finish the job. You don't take them to the hospital afterward." He remembered Bryant's gesture as the two cars ground against each other, the cocked thumb ripping across the throat, the grin. His mouth tightened, and he picked up the Remington again. "You don't take them to the hospital, Chris. You finish the job." He stepped back and raised the weapon. Bryant saw it and flailed desperately about on the concrete. A broken moaning came out of his mouth. It looked as if he was trying to bring his working arm up to his shoulder holster and the Nemex, but he didn't have the strength. Chris clamped his mouth tighter, took another step back, and leveled the shotgun. Jagged motion, quick, before he could give it a thought. He'd stopped breathing. "Finish the fucking job, Chris." He squeezed the trigger. Nothing. No click, no detonation, no kick, no spray of blood and tissue. The trigger gave soggily through half the pull and stuck. Chris pulled harder. Still nothing. He worked the action and jacked a perfectly good unfired shell out into the air. It hit the concrete and rolled away, cheerfully cherry red. Mike's face pleading up at him. Squeezed again. Nothing. Fuck! It gritted out of him, as if he was afraid to be overheard in the empty warehouse. It still seemed to echo off the walls. Fuck! Fuck! The padlocks, hammering at the padlocks until they snapped and came loose. He remembered the savagery he'd brought to the action, the haphazard angles he'd been forced to use in the cage at the bottom of the stairs. He jammed the mechanism, jolted something, maybe broken something inside, irretrievably. He stood looking at Mike Bryant, wiped his mouth and swallowed. Finish it. Fucking finish it. He stalked closer, stared fascinated into the other man's eyes. Bryant gaped up at him, twitching. He made noises that sounded like the name Chris, the word please. For some reason, it was enough. Fuck you, Mike, he said quickly. You had your chance. He turned the injured man's head with one foot, reversed the Remington, and jammed the butt of the weapon into Bryant's exposed throat, leaned his full weight on the gun. Fuck you, Mike! Now he was spitting it, bent over and glaring into Bryant's face. Fuck you, all of you suited fuckers! It seemed to take forever. At first, Bryant only made choking sounds. Then, from somewhere, he found strength to get his undamaged arm up and grab the Remington around the trigger guard. Chris kicked the hand away and stood on it. He was panting. Mike's choking sounds grew frantic. He twisted his head against the concrete. He curled his trapped fingers around the edges of Chris's shoe, nails clawing at the Argentine leather. Chris leaned harder. Tears sprang out of his eyes and streamed down his face. He lifted his foot and stamped down, hard on Mike's hand. He heard the dry snap as one of the fingers broke. He leaned harder, his whole weight lifting on the braced shotgun, taking his body almost off the floor. Something crunched. Mike stopped moving. Afterward, Chris could barely get himself upright. It was as if the shotgun had suddenly become indispensable, as if he'd been afflicted with a sudden muscular disease. He limped back from the corpse, trembling so violently his teeth chattered. He made less than a dozen steps. He bent, suddenly double, and finally threw up. A thin helping of vomit and bile. He'd barely eaten that morning, but what he had came up. He dropped to his knees in a puddle, retching. The sound of boots through the wet. He looked up, only vaguely interested, and saw the men. Big, blocky forms in the filtering light from outside, like knights in armor from some medieval fantasy. He blinked to clear his eyes. There were nine of them, dressed in the cordoned zone gangwit ensemble, cheap, grimed clothes, loose canvas trousers, bulky, padded jackets, shaven heads and work boots. Hands held crowbars, wrenches, sawn-off pool cues, and a variety of other items too jagged to identify. Faces were scarred with street-fight souvenirs, eyes watchful on the scene they'd just interrupted. He got unsteadily to his feet. One of the men stepped forward. He was near 2 meters tall, heavily muscled under a sleeveless T-shirt scrawled red with the legend, "I am the Minister for the Redistribution of Health." The lettering was splattered to make it look bloody. His face was scarred from the corner of the left eye down the cheek. It gave him an oddly mournful look.
"Finished, have you? Is he dead?"
Chris blinked and coughed.
"Who are you?"
he asked harshly.
"Who are we?"
Laughter rasped out, first from one throat, then building to a rattling echo off the metal roof. It died out as abruptly. The gangwit spokesman was swinging a short, black enameled crowbar softly and repeatedly into his left palm. His gaze seemed welded to Chris, playing up and down the clothes, the hair, the shotgun. He smiled, and the scar tissue tugged at his face.
"Who are we? We're the fucking dispossessed, mate. That's who we are."
There was no laughter to follow this time. The men had tautened, waiting for the leash to slip. Chris suppressed another cough and lifted the Remington as convincingly as he could manage.
That's close enough. The police are on their way, and there's nothing to see here.
Yeah?
The spokesman for the group gestured at the BMW and Mike Bryant's corpse.
From what we've seen so far, I beg to differ. This is prime time, Mr. Faulkner.
Chris pumped the action on the Remington.
All right. I said that's close enough.
Mistake. The unspent shell leapt in the air, hit the concrete, and rolled toward the other man. For a moment, they both looked down at it. Then the gangwit looked back up at Chris and shook his head.
See, that's a perfectly good round, mate. And to judge by your manner of execution back there a moment ago, I'd say...
Chris flung the shotgun in his face and ran. Back to the upturned BMW and Mike Bryant's corpse. He heard booted feet behind him, more than one pair. The gangwit's voice rang exasperated above the clatter.
Well, don't fucking stand there! Get him!
He dived and landed on Mike in a kind of embrace, scrabbled under the jacket, felt the butt of the Nemex in his hand. Proximity sense told him the first of his pursuers was almost on him. Shadows blocked out the light, the smell of old leather and cheap aftershave swamped him. A hand grabbed at his jacket. He rolled free and came up with Mike's gun almost touching the gangwit's chest. He saw the man's eyes widen. A pool cue smashed down on his shoulder. He squeezed the trigger. The Nemex thundered. The shot kicked the man off his feet and back across the concrete. He crumpled and lay still.
Toby!
It was a howl of anguish. The gangwit spokesman.
Fucking executive piece of shit!
The second gangwit was 2 paces behind his fallen comrade, but the gun brought him to a dead halt. The others were converging, but now they stopped and began to back away, left and right. Chris got himself upright, grinning fiercely.
That's right. Back the fuck off.
Something black whipped through the air and hit him a numbing blow across the elbow. The Nemex went off, firing wide into the concrete floor. Chris clutched at his arm and tried to bring the gun to bear as the spokesman, leaping in after the hurled crowbar, hit him from the right. Below the elbow, his muscles were water. He snapped off a panic shot. It went wide. The gangwit snarled a grin and grabbed the arm, twisting. Chris felt his hand spasm open. The Nemex spun away, splashing into a puddle. He threw a punch, left-handed, and saw his opponent ride it with a street fighter's impatient grunt. Desperate, he reached and grappled. The Minister for the Redistribution of Health punched him in the chest with shattering force. He collapsed backward, fending weakly, tripping on Mike's corpse. The gangwit let him go, let him fall against the body of the upturned BMW, and turned to scoop up his crowbar. Stalked forward, still grinning. Chris saw the attack coming and rolled weakly left along the BMW's flank. The crowbar arced down and clawed a long dint in the twilight blue bodywork where he'd been. The metal screeched. Chris came off the car yelling, delivered a hooking left-handed punch to the minister's temple. The gangwit threw up a block that didn't quite cover and staggered slightly with the impact. He grunted again, shook his head, and whipped the crowbar around. Chris caught it across the side of the head. Multicolored light rang in his skull. The ceiling waltzed by overhead. He reeled and fell. Something snagged his arm. He looked muzzily and saw the minister had him, was holding him up, comfortably.
"Fucking piece of shit, driver!" the man was yelling in his face. "Come into the fucking zones with your suit, will you?"
The crowbar slammed into his ribs. He screamed like a baby and twisted. There were others around him, holding him up for the spokesman, cuffing him back and forth across the head.
"Come into the fucking zones, will you? Hold him!"
Another blow, another rolling tide of numbness. He thought he felt a rib crack this time. He yelled, but weakly. The grip on his arm let go, and he slumped into a ring of supporting grasps. He saw a fist coming, heavy with dull metal rings. It split his vision apart, sent shards of it spinning away against the roaring darkness. He felt part of his face tear, felt blood streaming down into his collar.
"Show you what we think of,"
the minister was telling him between blows. But the rest was carried away on the roar in an opening tunnel of darkness. Oddly, in the bottom of it all, he heard Carla. "So, you just want to fuck me and leave me, is that it?" Her hands on him. She was smiling. For some reason he couldn't pin down, he wanted to laugh and cry at the same time. "I'm already sliding headlong into the dark. Not going anywhere." But he was. And a sound like distant thunder. Chapter 48. Driver-control helicopters held the sky over the vaulted highway where Chris Faulkner had slewed the Saab to its shrieking sideways halt. Bright sunlight winked off underslung camera lenses and the clustered barrels of the Gatlings. At a prudent distance beyond, news crew aircraft circled like sharks waiting for something to give up and die. There were police vehicles scattered up and down the stretch, equipment set up, and armed figures hurrying about. Louise Hewitt stood talking to a ranking tactical force officer and her cell phone at the same time. She looked up and shielded her face as a new twilight blue helicopter drifted in through the black and green driver control machines and settled to the asphalt 20 meters away. Jack Notley climbed down from the cabin, settled his suit a little more firmly on his shoulders in the gale of the rotors, and strode toward her.
"I'll call you back," she told the phone and snapped it shut. "And, Captain, if you could just give me a moment."
The officer saw who was coming and stepped back. Notley reached Hewitt and stared at her.
"Well?"
"I expect you've heard."
"That's why I'm here."
Notley looked grim.
"What have you got?"
Hewitt shrugged and nodded toward the crane and winch system at the edge of the gullet.
"We put in the tacks. Apparently they're bringing them both up now. Not a pretty sight, is what I was told."
Notley looked away, up and down the stretch of highway.
4 miles,
he said.
4 miles from where Page went off. Do you realize that?"
"Four?"
Hewitt frowned.
"Oh, miles. That's what, about 6 kilometers? Yes, probably about that. And not far from where Barnes learned to fly, come to that."
"Yes."
"Exciting stretch of road."
The winch whined into action. Both partners turned to watch as it brought up a sheet-covered stretcher. Tactical Force Corporate Police swarmed around the load, swinging it in and lowering it gently to the road. The covering was white, and blood had soaked through in small patches. A medic crouched, turned back the sheet and winced visibly. The winch swung back down. They watched the cable unwind.
"Going to be a lot of questions," observed Hewitt when it stopped. "Lot of precedent to be hammered out."
Notley grunted.
"Good. Kind of thing that keeps us sharp."
"Keeps the lawyers sharp, you mean? They're going to be arguing this one back and forth for months at our expense."
"Well, we go ahead and get on with doing things anyway."
"Ethics after the event." Hewitt offered him a crooked smile. "My favorite kind."
Notley raised an eyebrow.
"Are there any other sort?"
The winch swung up again. More activity, another stretcher settling to the asphalt. More bloodstains on white.
"Not in this world."
"I'm glad."
Amid the weaving of the tactical force uniforms, commotion. Uniforms milling. And Chris Faulkner, climbing off the stretcher like the living dead, pushing his way clear. A ragged cheer floated over him like a banner. Hewitt froze. Notley blinked. Then the senior partner was striding rapidly toward the new arrival, a grin broadening on his face. He only faltered as he got closer and saw the damage. Chris's face was a mask of blood and bruising. One eye swollen almost shut, ribbons of torn flesh around the mouth and both cheeks ripped, blood from a nose that looked broken. The way he moved under the abused and blooded suit screamed cracked ribs.
"Chris! Jesus, fuck, you're alive! I thought... you had me worried for a moment there. Congratulations!"
Chris stared at him. Stared past him, like the zombie he so closely resembled. Notley grabbed his shoulders.
"You've done it, Chris. You won! You're a partner at 33 years old. Fucking unprecedented! Congratulations! You know what this means?"
Chris looked sideways at him, focused.
"What does it mean?"
he whispered.
"What does it mean?"
Notley was almost burbling.
"Chris, it means you're at the top! From here on up, there's nothing you can't do. Nothing. Welcome aboard!"
He thrust out his hand. Chris looked down at it as if the gesture didn't make sense. He made a coughing noise that it took Notley a moment to realize was laughter. Then he stared up into the senior partner's face and off past it again. The Saab. Hewitt.
Chris?
Excuse me.
He pushed past Notley, pacing a steady line for Hewitt. She saw him coming and tensed. A brief nod to the tactical captain and the man was at her shoulder. Chris came to a halt a meter away, swaying a little.
"Louise,"
he husked. She manufactured a small smile.
"Hello, Chris. Well done."
"This is for you, Louise."
He held it out. The Shawn Associates card, Mike Bryant's name, engraved and streaked across with new blood.
"I don't think now is..."
"No, it's for you."
Chris took another sudden step in and tucked the card into Hewitt's breast pocket. He nodded to himself, already turning away.
"For you. Because that's the way we do things around here, right?"
Hewitt's smile was frozen on.
"Right.
I'll see you on the road, Louise."
He walked away, dipping in his pocket for keys. The door of the Saab was still wide open. Driver control personnel busied themselves around it, measuring and photographing. When he tried to get in behind the wheel, one of them barred his way.
"Sorry, sir, we're not finished here yet."
He backed up as Chris looked at him.
"Get out of my way."
The man retreated. Chris eased himself into the seat, teeth clenching up as his hastily taped ribs grated with the move. The medics had shot him full of something warm, but the pain was still getting through in flinty little flashes. He sat for a while, breathing it under control. He thought it would probably be manageable. He closed the door, reached for the ignition. The Saab fired up, growling. Around him, up and down the gullet, activity stopped at the sound. Heads turned. He saw people gesturing. No one seemed interested in stopping him. He moved his head, a little awkwardly, coughed and tasted blood, checked the rear view and cut a smooth circle in reverse so the car was pointing southward, toward Shawn. He shifted gear, let the vehicle start to glide forward.
"Sir, wait!"
Muffled through the seal of the closed doors and windows, a uniformed tactical hurried across and rapped on his window. He cranked it down and waited, foot light on the clutch, barely holding the Saab back. The TAC hesitated.
Sir, it's just... the shooting down there. Well, we arrived sort of in the nick of time, sir, so it was a bit rushed. Just trying to get them off you know."
"Yes."
His voice still wasn't working properly. It had taken him whole minutes lying there on the concrete to make sense of the thunder, the screams of men dying, and then the urgent voices of the TACs as they circled him, the ring of concerned faces peering down.
"Yes. Thank you."
"Yes, well, thing is, a firefight like that, you don't always get everyone dead center. And now it looks like at least a couple are going to live. I assume you're going to be pressing charges, sir."
"Yes, all right."
"Well, I'll need a number for you, sir, for the statement. Obviously we can get you at Shawn, but we'd like to provide a full personalized service in cases like this. Victim support, one-to-one interviews, we can come out to you any time. And I'm the officer assigned, so... do you, have a home number, sir?"
Chris closed his eyes briefly.
"No, not really."
"Oh." The TAC looked at him for a moment, puzzled. "Well, anyway, I'll get you at Shawn, then."
"Yes."
He tried to curb a flooding tide of impatience. He wanted to be gone.
Is that all you need?
Oh, yes, sir. But, you know, congratulations. The duel and everything. My whole family were watching it. Well done. Fantastic driving. Oh, my son's a huge fan, sir. He fought down the urge to cackle, hid it in a cough.
That's nice.
I expect you'll be on the screen a lot the next few weeks. Probably even get an interview with Liz Linshaw, eh? The tack saw the look on his face and stepped back. Anyway, I'll let you go, sir. Thanks.
No problem.
He let the Saab roll forward. People got out of the way. He moved past Louise Hewitt and then Jack Notley, gathering speed. By the time he passed the last of the uniforms and the parked police vehicles, he was closing on 90. The Saab took the curve on a rising growl. He hit a pothole, but the suspension and the onset of the painkillers damped it out. He reached for the phone, jabbed it on, winced only a little this time as his cracked ribs jarred. He placed a forward call to Joaquin Lopez in Panama, 10 minutes ahead. Then he dialed Sean's priority client operator and told them to get him Francisco Echevarria immediately. They didn't like it. They didn't know if...
Tell him it's a national emergency, Chris suggested.
It took a couple of minutes, but Echevarria grabbed the call. He wasn't pleased. Chris got the impression the ride in the last week had been bumpy.
Bryant! That you? Now fucking what? What national fucking emergency you talking about?
The one that's kind of put you in front of a fucking firing squad, you piece of shit. This is Chris Faulkner.
Strangled silence, then fury.
You motherfucking...
Shut up and listen, Paco. I don't know what line of shit they've been handing you in my absence, but things just changed for the better. Mike Bryant is dead.
You're lying.
No, I'm not. I killed him myself. With my bare fucking hands. So I'm now junior partner at Sean Conflict Investment, which means executive partner for the name account, which means you, Paco. And I'm telling you, I'm going to have Vicente Barranco in the streets of Bogota by the end of this fucking month, so if I were you, I would gather up as much of my father's stolen loot as I could get in a Learjet, and I would fuck off out of the name right now while I could still walk to the plane.
Echevarria lost English in the storm of his fury. Spanish washed down the line beyond Chris's ability to follow. He cut across it.
You've got 48 hours, Paco. That's it. After that, I'm sending special air to put a bullet in your face.
You cannot do this!
This time Chris really laughed. Across the pain in his broken ribs, across all the pain. The drugs were numbing him nicely.
You still don't get it, do you, Paco? From where I'm sitting, I can do whatever the fuck I want. Men like me, there's nothing you can do to stop us anymore. Understand? There is nothing you can do anymore.
He killed the call. Fed power to the Saab, and watched as his speed climbed. Gave himself up to the snarl of the engine, the spreading numbness of the drugs in his system, and the onrushing emptiness of the road ahead. This concludes Market Forces by Richard K. Morgan.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.